Deliberate indifference. It's a funny phrase, especially when used in the context of seeing someone else suffer. In most cases, most people would feel something in the presence of pain. If it's a friend or loved one in pain, almost anyone would feel bad and want to help out. If it's someone who has caused pain to the observer, she might be happy to see the shoe on the other foot, or she might be the forgiving type. Sometimes bystanders can be indifferent to the plight of strangers. Back in July, five teenagers mockingly videotaped a drowning man in Florida. But the word deliberate means carefully weighed or considered. I'd probably describe the indifference displayed by these teenagers as flippant or unthinking. The phrase deliberate indifference seems to be a better fit for someone who remains unfeeling for months or even years. In fact, the phrase seems to describe a virus more than a human being. On World AIDS Day, HIV advocate Lizzie Jordan wrote that, "Here's the thing with a virus like HIV. A virus doesn't see boxes, doesn't see people, doesn't see your gender, your sexuality, your skin color or your age. Doesn't see how often you have sex or how you like to have sex. It simply wants a home. It wants a host in which to replicate itself. It doesn't discriminate." And the World Health Organization notes that viral hepatitis doesn't discriminate. Neither should you. HIV gets most of the press, but it's hepatitis C that kills more Americans than any other infectious disease. And the number of new infections nearly tripled between 2010 and 2015. Largely due to increased injection drug use tied to the opioid epidemic. But as large as the Hep C problem is in the streets of New York and the streets of New Mexico, it's worse in correctional facilities. And according to a spate of lawsuits across the country, it's getting worse. In each of these lawsuits, judges must answer this question: are state and Department of Corrections officials being deliberately indifferent to the plight of infected inmates? Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. Today's special episode is Deliberate Indifference.
Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the entire country, and their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everybody. They do this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Now, the older I get, the more careful I am about the kinds of ingredients I bring into my home to make meals for my family. And Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States that produce the kinds of meats and produce that I want to make for my family. So, as a result, their seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. Their beef, chicken, all their meat comes from responsibly raised animals, and their produce comes from farms that practices regenerative farming. Blue Apron also ships the exact amount of every ingredient that you need for a recipe, so there is no food waste. And they are affordable because they cost less than $10 per person per meal to make your family seasonal recipes with pre-proportioned ingredients and make delicious home-cooked meals. And the variety is amazing because they have new recipes every week. You can choose them or you can let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are never repeated in the same year, so you will never get bored. Now, you can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. Again, go to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
The word hepatitis comes from the Greek heper, meaning liver, and itis, meaning inflammation. There's both non-viral hepatitis and viral hepatitis, which covers hepatitis A through hepatitis G. I spoke with Dr. Darren Russell, a clinical associate professor at the University of Melbourne, about hepatitis C, which was first discovered in 1989.
The virus is passed on predominantly through blood. So it can be spread through blood transfusions if the blood supply is not protected against Hep C. And it passes on most commonly through injecting drug use, Unclean tattoos can also do it. Not passed on sexually very often at all, but some HIV positive men in particular can pass it on. Gay men can pass it on in that way. So they're the common ways that it passes on. Most people who get hepatitis C won't have too many problems with it, and some will even clear it themselves. So about a quarter of people who get infected just clear it spontaneously and it disappears. Their own immune system gets rid of it. But three quarters don't, and they go on to have chronic hepatitis C, and a portion of those will eventually have liver damage and cirrhosis, which is scarring of the liver, and even liver cancer, and can die of the disease.
Hepatitis C is a progressive infection with four different levels or stages. I talked about them with Sean Hemmerly. He is a former inmate who now works for a syringe exchange program in Tacoma, Washington.
There's basically like four different levels, and then full-blown cirrhosis, with level four being, with cirrhosis being the worst, but, you know, one, two, three, four, one being the least damage, four being, you know, the worst damage.
Specifically, in stage one, there's mild inflammation of the liver, but little to no scarring. In stage two, there's mild to moderate fibrosis, or the thickening and scarring of connective tissue. As the virus progresses to stage three, there's bridging fibrosis, which means that the scarring has spread to different parts of the liver. Finally, in stage four, there's cirrhosis, an advanced form of liver disease in which the liver becomes so scarred that it can no longer heal itself. Eventually, untreated hepatitis C can lead to fatal liver failure or liver cancer. In 2002, there were about 11,000 hepatitis C-related deaths in the U.S. That same year, Oregon attorney Michelle Burrows filed what I believe to be the first class action lawsuit based upon inmates not being treated for hepatitis C. I recently had the chance to speak to Burrows about the lawsuit.
A gentleman who was working as a paralegal at the Oregon State Prison, which is our only maximum security prison in Oregon, had observed a trend, at least within his prison, that there were a number of inmates who had hepatitis C but were not getting any treatment. They weren't even being evaluated. And many times they weren't told that they were positive for HCV until some months or years afterward.
For Burroughs, this created almost a moral imperative to act.
I think what I wanted to do at the time, it just seemed extremely inhumane and terrible that prison system wouldn't even tell people if they were infected, and they weren't even doing anything to help them. Because as the disease progresses and as the liver fails, the side effects of that disease progress is really very bad. It's horrible, it's painful, and death is gruesome. So I just felt it was wrong. It needed to be fixed.
Burroughs soon learned that the Department of Corrections was giving five reasons for not treating Oregon inmates, including the claim that some are too sick to be treated.
They would give the reason that being cirrhotic, which is sort of the end stage of HCV, when your liver becomes cirrhotic, they would say, well, we can't give you the treatment because you have cirrhosis, which was not really the medical standard at the time.
So Burroughs brought a class action lawsuit with 10 class representatives, including two inmates who were denied for each of the five reasons. Burroughs was able to get prison medical records and determined that between 30% and 40% of inmates in Oregon had hepatitis C. Most of those inmates, about 3,000, became class members in the lawsuit. Burroughs seemingly had a pretty strong case.
You know, and part of the lawsuit, I think the biggest thrust of the lawsuit is they didn't even have a plan for how to treat hepatitis C. They were just going to ignore it.
But as is often the case, the litigation dragged on for months and then years, this time with tragic consequences for the class representatives.
Joe Morales died. Roger Amstutz died. I think half of them died by the time we finished with the lawsuit.
But finally, the lawsuit succeeded. On April 6, 2004, a settlement was reached, which led to the appointment of a three-person medical review panel.
They developed a hepatitis C treatment protocol, which talked about timelines. When you get tested and you test positive, they have to tell you within 30 days. If you have, and your genotype should be mapped. So once that happened, and they could try and tell the progress of the disease, they would start treatment for people who were at a particular disease progress.
The This probably remains the biggest victory in a prison hepatitis C lawsuit, but the result didn't really resonate in other areas of the country, including Oregon's neighbor to the north. I mentioned before that I spoke to Sean Hemmerly, a former inmate in Washington with hepatitis C. When Hemmerly was incarcerated in 2010, he already had a hepatitis C diagnosis. According to Hemmerly, everyone who is incarcerated in Washington starts out in the Washington Correction Center in Shelton, Washington.
They have opt-in testing there, so like you have to tell them that you want to get tested for it. I told them that I was already diagnosed and I had it. They still had to do a blood draw to confirm it because they didn't want to believe me.
The testing confirmed that Hemmerly had hepatitis C, but before he could get treated, he was transferred to the Coyote Ridge Correctional Center.
Once I got there, I told him that that I had already been diagnosed. I did a blood draw on Shelton, and that I'd still like to start treatment. They finally got the results from Shelton a month or two later, called me down to the medical there in Coyote Ridge, and did another blood draw because they had to confirm my viral load at that moment. By then, 7, 8, 9 months had passed.
So Coyote Ridge did the testing, but they had to send it out to an external lab.
By the time they finally got the sample back and actually confirmed that, I did actually have this, virus that I've been telling them about from day one, and that it was, genotype 1, that it would be treatable with interferon, I was too close to getting out for them to be able to start interferon.
Of course, it doesn't make sense, but Washington and Oregon are actually in a certain sense better than most of the states in this country with regard to hepatitis C in prison. As Hemmerly noted, there is opt-out hepatitis C testing in Washington prisons, and the same goes for Oregon. That means that every inmate entering a correctional facility in those two states will be tested for hep C unless they opt out. But they're in the minority. 40 states responded to a recent survey about opt-out testing. 15 states had such testing, 25 states didn't. Previously, there might have been a partial explanation for this lack of testing, and that's the lack of efficacy in the drugs used to treat hepatitis C. Here's Dr. Russell again.
The previous treatments were pretty awful. They were based on a drug called interferon, which is an injection given once a week and tablets twice a day. And side effects were terrible and there were lots of problems. People with mental health issues often couldn't use these medications because of the side effects.
But now there's a new treatment. Direct-acting antivirals, or DAAs. The main targets of these DAAs are the HCV-encoded proteins that are vital to the replication of the virus. Some DAA drugs have close to 100% success rate in curing hepatitis C. The drugs also have many fewer side effects than interferon-based drugs. I spoke with Dr. Jennifer Clark at the Rhode Island Department of Corrections about DAAs.
Oh, they're so much better. People would feel terribly ill on the old treatments. It's a pleasure to treat people now because of the so few side effects.
This then sets the stage for the spate of lawsuits I mentioned before. The prevalence of hepatitis C in prisons varies from state to state. In my home state of South Carolina, 3% of inmates are infected. In North Carolina, it's only 1%. But in New Hampshire, 1 in 3 prisoners has hepatitis C. And in New Mexico, the number is 40%. States also differ in how many inmates are being treated, which has led to the spate of lawsuits across the country. In Missouri, more than 5,000 inmates have hepatitis C, and yet no more than a dozen of them are being treated. This has led to the ACLU of Missouri to file a class action lawsuit on behalf of Missouri inmates with hepatitis C. One of the claims is under the Americans with Disabilities Act, alleging that hepatitis C is being treated differently than every other medical issue in prison. Here's Tony Rother, who brought the lawsuit. Rother has also claimed that the failure to treat is cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment. It's a claim that's also been made in a class action lawsuit in Colorado, where fewer than 70 inmates have been treated per year, despite thousands being infected. Here's Mark Silverstein of the ACLU of Colorado describing the claim.
The legal standard is that prison officials, they violate the Eighth Amendment if they're deliberately indifferent to serious medical needs. So the prison officials have a constitutional obligation to provide medical treatment for serious medical needs. I don't think anybody would dispute that chronic hepatitis C is a serious medical need, and these new medications are the professionally accepted clinical standard of care for treating chronic hepatitis C.
The deliberate indifference standard referenced by Silverstein derives from the 1976 Supreme Court case Estelle versus Gamble. In Gamble, J.W. Gamble, a Texas inmate, was injured when a bale of cotton fell on him when he was unloading a truck. After this event, Gamble refused to work, citing severe back pain and hypertension. This led to Gamble being brought before the Unit Disciplinary Committee. Here's Gamble's attorney arguing his case before the Supreme Court.
On January 31st, Gamble went before the Unit Disciplinary Committee because he had refused to go to work. One of the people who testified at that disciplinary committee meeting was the Captain Blunt, who he had seen on so many occasions at the infirmary. Now, about 3 weeks previous to this, Captain Blunt had prescribed for Gamble hypertension medication and pain medication. At the time of the hearing, Gamble was still receiving this medication. He was in a physical condition which required hypertension medicine and back medicine. Blunt testified at this Unit Disciplinary Committee hearing that this man is in first-class medical condition. First-class medical condition means this man can go out in the fields and go back to work on those 600-pound bales of cotton or whatever heavy labor there is. Immediately following this, he was put into solitary confinement. There was no medical examination of him before he was put into solitary confinement. This is a textbook example of deliberate indifference by prison officials to the medical needs of this individual.
This is the same standard that judges in Missouri, Colorado, and about 8 other states will apply to determine whether the rights of inmates with hepatitis C across the country are being violated. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job at all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 200 plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. There's no juggling emails or calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. That's ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. One more time to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. So will these lawsuits be successful? There's reason to believe the answer will be yes, based upon a lawsuit brought by the man once dubbed the world's most famous death row prisoner. Mumia Abu-Jamal is an activist and the former president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. Early in the morning of December 9, 1981, Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner pulled over a vehicle belonging to Abu-Jamal's younger brother. During the traffic stop, Abu-Jamal, who was working as a cab driver, was parked in his taxi across the street. Abu-Jamal's brother and Faulkner became involved in an altercation that ended with Abu-Jamal and Faulkner both being shot, with Faulkner's injury being fatal. Abu-Jamal was convicted of murder and given the death penalty, with that sentence later being commuted to life imprisonment in 2001. Since Abu-Jamal's conviction, there have been vigorous claims that he is innocent and that another passenger in their brother's vehicle shot Faulkner. On the other side, several groups, including the Fraternal Order of Police, have said the right man is in prison. What's not in dispute, though, is that Abu-Jamal later became infected with hepatitis C in prison and was not properly treated. Here's one of Abu-Jamal's doctors describing some of his symptoms.
And he was in the infirmary for a long time to care for this very difficult skin situation. It's an itchy, rash skin that at one point covered 70% of his body, and that the doctors who, I read all the medical records as one of his medical consultants, and the doctors who were treating him wrote notes of shock and awe over the sheets of skin peeling off his back and things like that during the worst of the crisis.
The state claimed that Abu-Jamal was suffering from psoriasis, but his doctor convincingly claimed that this was necrolytic acral erythema, a rare skin condition that's a cutaneous marker of hepatitis C. As a result, like the current class members in Missouri and Colorado, Abu-Jamal brought an Eighth Amendment claim. I spoke to his attorney, Bob Boyle, about the state's response.
Well, the response was that, yeah, it's true he has chronic hepatitis C. It's true that he's suffering from all of these complications. It's true that he probably has significant fibrosis, which means scarring of the liver. But we think he doesn't need the medication now, and we can just continue testing him. And if his condition deteriorates, maybe then we'll give him the drug. That was their response to our lawsuit.
Abu-Jamal's lawsuit focused on the efficacy of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections wait-and-see protocol for treatment of hepatitis C.
The efficacy of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections protocol for administering hepatitis C drugs, which insists that someone deteriorate to cirrhosis, even worse than that, that they have esophageal varices, which is bleeding in your esophagus, before they give you these drugs.
Given this protocol, it's perhaps unsurprising that the court ruled in Abu-Jamal's favor.
The judge ruled in early 2017 that, actually January 3rd of 2017, that the standard of care for everyone is administering of the antiviral medication, more specifically in Mr. Abu-Jamal's case, Harvoni, because that fits his genotype, that it's an Eighth Amendment violation that the prison is aware that he has a disease which can cause death and is the largest cause of death in the United States for infectious diseases, and that they refuse to administer a drug that will cure that disease.
Of course, Boyle's answer also supplies the best response that states might have against Eighth Amendment claims. Cost. 12-week regimen of Harvoni costs about $95,000. But not for everyone. I spoke with Adam Beckman and Greg Gonsalves, two of the authors of a research paper on the cost of hepatitis C drugs for state prisons. When they spoke to officials at the Connecticut Department of Corrections, they got the following response.
So we went up to Weathersfield and we met with the warden and Kathy Maurer, who's the physician who was in charge of the corrections department health system. And to our surprise, they said, you know, we really would love to actually treat patients with hepatitis C. And one of our main concerns is that, you know, we as a state have a fixed budget, and the corrections program's budget is for health is outsourced to the University of Connecticut Health Center, which supplies direct services to prisoners. But they said, so the price of the drugs is actually prohibitive. You know, if we treat one patient with hepatitis C, you know, just think about what that means in terms of the overall cost and the trade-offs within our health spending for the prison overall in any given year. And we said, well, you know, we feel the same way. These drugs are, you know, $1,000 per pill and $80,000 off-the-shelf cost for them, and we don't think the price is right. Moreover, because they are state prisons and jails, they do not get this concessionary pricing that Medicaid or other federal programs get. And if you're a small state like Connecticut, you don't even have the sort of clout with the industry to sort of make any demands about reducing prices like a state like California or New York would have.
And therein lies the problem. Federal entities such as the VA and even federal prisons get significant discounts in the price of hepatitis C drugs, while state prisons do not.
The prisons are not the only ones left out in the cold, but definitely are probably the worst case scenario.
So how do we solve this problem? The researchers got a group of Department of Corrections representatives, researchers, and others to discuss the issue and came up with two possible solutions.
One of the issues that came up was perhaps I could pull their procurement across states, particularly so the smaller states band together and try to get a cheaper price in a state like Rhode Island or Connecticut to get on its own. The other thing is there's the ability to sort of partner with programs that have 340B federal discounts, and often federally qualified health centers and others get this discount. And there's states like Texas and others who have hooked up with the 340B eligible entity to get the 340B pricing on the drugs. But again, the 340B pricing program is under some scrutiny in Washington, D.C., and it's not sure if that's a long-term solution to the state's issues around pricing for the prisons.
340B is a program that allows certain qualifying facilities like hospitals that serve large numbers of low-income patients to get drug discounts. State prisons partnering with these qualifying institutions makes a good deal of sense, but again, there's no guarantee that 340B will even be around next year. And that takes us to a novel and controversial approach that's been proposed in Louisiana. It relies upon using a 1910 patent law contained in Section 1410 of Title 28 of the U.S. Code. I spoke with Rachel Sachs about the possibility. She's a professor at the Washington University School of Law.
So 1498 allows the government to use, quote, an invention described in or covered by a patent, unquote, where the use is by or for the United States, as long as reasonable and entire compensation is provided. So let me say a little bit more about each of those requirements. So Section 1498 goes beyond other statutes that allow the government to march in and use particular patents that may have resulted from federal funding, for instance, as is provided for in the Bayh-Dole Act. And Section 1498 speaks in terms of the invention itself, not just a particular patent. And so in a situation where most inventions will be covered by multiple patents, only some of which will be subject to government use of the type described in other statutes, 1498 provides an additional tool for the government to use that won't be found in other statutes. And then second is that the use has to be by or for the United States. And I think it's really easy to see how public insurance programs like the Medicare or Medicaid programs or even use in the federal prison system would be by or for the United States. But with populations like people incarcerated in state prisons or even in the uninsured population, it's a little bit of a tougher case to make, although there isn't a lot of precedent about exactly what this term means.
Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. Mack Weldon promises that their products will be the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants you'll ever wear. And I can say personally as a customer, they make good in that promise. I have their socks, their boxer shorts, their undershirts, and they're the most comfortable clothes I've ever worn. But not only do Mack Weldon's underwear, socks, and shirts look good, they perform well too. It's good for working out, going to work, going out on dates, everyday life. And now, as an undisclosed listener, you can go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using the promo code undisclosed. And they want you to be comfortable, so if you don't like the first pair, you can keep it and they'll still refund you. No questions asked. Again, that's MackWeldon.com and you can get 20% off using the promo code undisclosed. So here's how Section 1498 would work in this context. Even though a drug company like Harvoni has a patent on hepatitis C medication, the federal government could use Section 1498 to sidestep that patent and contract with a generic drug supplier to provide a lower-priced version of the same drug to prisons. As Professor Sachs notes, though, there are questions about whether using Section 1498 would satisfy the section's test of serving the public good and what reasonable compensation would be due to drug companies like Harvoni. But using Section 1498 in a similar fashion certainly isn't unprecedented.
So Section 1498 has been used for decades since its passage in its current form in the 40s for the government, especially for the Department of Defense, to obtain all kinds of technologies. But in the 50s and 60s, it was particularly used by the federal government to get medications at reasonable prices. And we really haven't seen its use in the pharmaceutical context since the early 70s. There was an instance in the post-9/11 climate where its use was threatened. but ultimately not invoked, where the manufacturer of a product just gave a license at a much lower price. But it is still used today, especially by the Department of Defense, to get lower prices on other types of goods.
But let's say that none of these solutions pan out, and states are left wondering whether they should spend their money treating problems afflicting average citizens versus those affecting those who have committed crimes. Well, as several interviewees pointed out, in this case, those interests actually align. Here's Mandy Altman, the Correctional Health Program Manager for the Hepatitis Education Project.
The best way to get a handle on hepatitis C in the United States would be to treat all prisoners who have hepatitis C, because everyone in prison that has hep C, about 90-95% of prisoners are going to be released back into society. So if they have hepatitis C and they get cured of hepatitis C, then they aren't spreading hepatitis C once they're out of prison. And prison has a great chance to treat people. Unfortunately, when someone goes into prison, they lose their health care and the prison becomes responsible for providing the treatment. So the prisons aren't given the money from their legislature that they need in order to buy that treatment.
A similar way of thinking recently influenced decision makers in Australia. There's a goal to have Cairn in Queensland, Australia become hepatitis C free by 2020. And the thinking was there's no way to achieve this goal without treating inmates. Again, here's Dr. Russell.
So we needed to get rid of the virus from the community, but also from the prison. There's no point in doing one or the other if you're aiming to eliminate hep C from a geographic area. This micro-elimination really requires the prisons and the injecting drug users on the outside to be free of hep C. And if one big pool of people is not free, then you'll get transmission no matter what that pool is. So we've worked hard to make sure that the prison is free, as are the people living outside the prison.
With this goal in mind, the federal government reduced the cost of hepatitis C drugs to correctional facilities. Prisons did opt-out testing, the prison staff bought in, so did the prisoners. At the Lotus Glen Correctional Center in Cairn, this produced an extraordinary result.
But the 1st of March last year, we were able to treat everyone, essentially, because we have these new oral tablets, which are really miracles in a sense at clearing hepatitis C quickly. So we put into place a treatment regimen at the prison to test everyone on entry, or nearly everyone, and to treat everyone we could for hepatitis C. And this has been successful to the extent that by the beginning of January this year, we'd essentially treated all the people in prison, and we're just mopping up the new ones who come in now. So it was an Australian first and potentially a world first.
So what are the health effects and behavioral changes that have resulted from Lotus Glen becoming hepatitis C free? Well, it's still early, but here are some takes by Sophia Bartlett, an academic at the Kirby Institute's Viral Hepatitis Clinical Research Program, and Dr. Russell.
So I guess the thing with hepatitis C is that because you don't really tend to see a whole lot of health effects until a chronic infection has progressed a lot longer, and I guess people in prison tend to be a little bit younger, you don't really see the health effects in prison so much as you see them outside in the community. And I guess we kind of consider prison to be sort of a reservoir for hepatitis C infection. So while you might not necessarily have a whole lot of prisoners who are sick from hepatitis C, you definitely have a lot of prisoners who are infected. And so I guess that's part of the reason why treating them is so important, because, you know, they're not necessarily going to stay in prison forever. And while they might not be sick right now, there is definitely an opportunity to treat them. In terms of behavioural changes, that's a question that we are going to be trying to answer through the studies that we're doing in the two prisons in New South Wales. We're looking at behavioural changes in terms of risk behaviour before and after treatment, and whether changes in behaviour can result in a lower likelihood of being reinfected.
I think just to add to that, we do see ill people in prison, and we do have prisoners who die of their hepatitis C. But as Sophia said, they tend to be older prisoners, and as prisons are largely filled with young males, we don't see so much of that. One thing we can say about Lotus Glen is that really a lot of the prison staff got on board with trying to get the prison hep C and keep it that way, and as did the inmates. They've really become quite proud of the fact that they're the first prison in Australia to have eliminated hep C, and they're keen to keep it that way too. So there has been a bit of a, I suppose, a social effect or a mental health effect with a bit of pride.
Will the United States and even other parts of Australia be able to achieve a similar result? It's tough to say, but whether through lawsuits or a variety of options available to the federal and state governments, there's reason for hope. What's important to note, though, is that even more so than in other cases, this is not just a prisoner issue. It's a public health issue, and it's possible that, beyond the ethics of the situation, millions of dollars spent now could save billions of dollars later. On the other hand, putting money aside, if states and correctional facilities continue to treat merely a fraction of inmates infected with hepatitis C, are they being deliberately indifferent? Legally speaking, we should have a series of answers coming pretty soon. Thanks for listening to this special episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories podcast for audio production, Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Telhan, our executive producer. Susan will be back next Monday with another episode in her series on the Gary Mitchum Reeves case.